Chapter 37. Daylight of the streets. The secret of our emotions never lies in the bare object, but in its subtle relations to our own past. No wonder the secret escapes the unsympathizing observer, who might as well put on his spectacles to discern odors. But there was one reason why even a chance-comer would have found the service in Aislip Church more impressive than in most other village nooks in the kingdom, a reason of which I am sure you have not the slightest suspicion. It was the reading of our friend Joshua Rann. Where that good shoemaker got his notion of reading from remained a mystery even to his most intimate acquaintances. I believe, after all, he got it chiefly from nature, who had poured some of her music into this honest, conceited soul, as she had been known to do into other narrow souls before his. As he had given him, at least, a fine bass voice and a musical ear, but I cannot positively say whether these alone had sufficed to inspire him with the rich chant in which he delivered the responses. The way he rolled from a rich deep forte into a melancholy cadence, subsiding, at the end of the last word, into a sort of faint resonance, like the lingering vibrations of a fine violoncello, I can compare to nothing for its strong calm melancholy, but the Russian cadence of the wind among the autumn boughs. This may seem a strange mode of speaking about the reading of a parish clerk, a man in rusty spectacles, with stubbly hair, a large occiput, and a prominent crown. But that is nature's way. She will allow a gentleman of splendid physiognomy and poetic aspirations to sing woefully out of tune, and not give him the slightest hint of it, and takes care that some narrow-browed fellow, trolling a ballad in the corner of a pothouse, shall be as true to his intervals as a bird. Joshua himself was less proud of his reading than of his singing, and it was always with a sense of heightened importance that he passed from the desk to the choir. Still more today. It was a special occasion, for an old man, familiar to all the parish, had died a sad death not in his bed, a circumstance the most painful to the mind of the peasant, and now the funeral psalm was to be sung in memory of his sudden departure. Moreover, Bartle Massey was not a church, and Joshua's importance in the choir suffered no eclipse. It was a solemn minor strain they sang. The old psalm tunes have many a wail among them, and the words, "Thou sweepest us off, as with a flood, we vanish hence like dreams," seem to have a closer application than usual in the death of poor Thias. The mother and sons listened, each with peculiar feelings. Lisbeth had a vague belief that the psalm was doing her husband good. It was part of that decent burial which she would have thought it a greater wrong to withhold from him than to have caused him many unhappy days while he was living. The more there was said about her husband, the more there was done for him, surely the safer he would be. It was poor Lisbeth's blind way of feeling that human love and pity are a ground of faith in some other love. Seth, who was easily touched, shed tears, and tried to recall, as he had done continually since his father's death, all that he had heard of the possibility that a single moment of consciousness at the last might be a moment of pardon and reconcilement. For was it not written in the very psalm they were singing that the divine dealings were not measured and circumscribed by time? Adam had never been unable to join in the psalm before. He had known plenty of trouble and vexation since he had been a lad, but this was the first sorrow that had hemmed in his voice, and strangely enough it was sorrow, because the chief source of his past trouble and vexation was forever gone out of his reach. He had not been able to press his father's hand before their parting, and say, "Father, you know it was all right between us. I never forgot what I owed you when I was a lad. You forgive me if I have been too hot and hasty now and then." Adam thought but little today of the hard work and the earnings he had spent on his father. His thoughts ran constantly on what the old man's feelings had been in moments of humiliation, when he had held down his head before the rebukes of his son. When our indignation is born in submissive silence, we are apt to feel twinges of doubt afterwards as to our own generosity, if not justice, How much more when the object of our anger has gone into everlasting silence, and we have seen his face for the last time in the meekness of death. Ah, I was always too hard, Adam said to himself. Tis a sore fault in me as I'm so odd, and out o' patience with people when they do wrong, and my heart gets shut up against them, so as I can't bring myself to forgive them. I see clear enough there's more pride nor love in my soul, for I could sooner make a thousand strokes with th hammer for my father than bring myself to say a kind word to him. And there went plenty o' pride and temper to the strokes, as the devil will be having his finger in what we call our duties as well as our sins. Mayhap the best thing I ever did in my life was only doing what was easiest for myself. It's always been easier for me to work nor to sit still, but the real tough job for me 'ud be to master my own will and temper and go right against my own pride. It seems to me now, if I was to find Father at home tonight, I should behave different. But there's no knowing, perhaps nothing 'ud be a lesson to us if it didn't come too late. It's well we should feel as life's a reckoning we can't make twice over. There's no real making amends in this world, any more nor you can mend a wrong subtraction by doing your addition right. This was the keynote to which Adam's thoughts had perpetually returned since his father's death, and the solemn wail of the funeral psalm was only an influence that brought back the old thoughts with stronger emphasis. So was the sermon, which Mr. Irwin had chosen with reference to Thiah's funeral. It spoke briefly and simply of the words, in the midst of life we are in death, how the present moment is all we can call our own for works of mercy, of righteous dealing, and of family tenderness. All very old truths, but what we thought the oldest truth becomes the most startling to us in the week, when we have looked on the dead face of one who has made a part of our own lives. For when men want to impress us with the effect of a new and wonderfully vivid light, do they not let it fall on the most familiar objects, that we may measure its intensity by remembering the former dimness? Then came the moment of the final blessing, when the forever sublime words, "The peace of God, which passeth all understanding," seemed to blend with the calm afternoon sunshine that fell on the bowed heads of the congregation. And then the quiet rising, the mothers tying on the bonnets of the little maidens who had slept through the sermon, the fathers collecting the prayer books, until all streamed out through the old archway into the green churchyard, and began their neighborly talk, their simple civilities, and their invitations to tea. For on a Sunday everyone was ready to receive a guest. It was the day when all must be in their best clothes and their best humor. Mr. and Mrs. Poyser paused a minute at the church gate. They were waiting for Adam to come up, not being contented to go away without saying a kind word to the widow and her sons. "Well, Mrs. Bede," said Mrs. Poyser, as they walked on together, "you must keep up your heart. Husbands and wives must be content when they've lived to rear their children and see one another's hair gray." Aye, said Mr. Poyser. "They wanna have long to wait for one another then, anyhow. And ye have got to owe the strappings, sons ith country, and well you may, for I remember poor Thiah's as fine a broad-shouldered fellow as need to be. And as for you, Mrs. Bede, why you're straighter eye the back, nor half the young women now." "Eh," said Lisbeth, "it's poor luck for the platter to wear well when it's broke eye too. The sooner I'm laid under the thorn the better. I'm no good to nobody now." Adam never took notice of his mother's little unjust plaints, but Seth said, "Nay, mother, thee mustna say so. Thy sons'll never get another mother." "That's true, lad, that's true," said Mr. Poyser, "and it's wrong on us to give way to grief, Mrs. Bede. For it's like the children crying when the fathers and mothers take things from 'em. There's one above knows better nor us." "Ah," said Mrs. Poyser, "and it's poor work a lay settin' the dead above the livin'. We shall all on us be dead some time. I reckon it 'ud be better if folks 'ud make much on us beforehand, istid o' beginnin' when we're gone. It's but little good you'll do a watering the last year's crop. Well, Adam, said Mr. Poyser, feeling that his wife's words were, as usual, rather incisive than soothing, and that it would be well to change the subject, you'll come and see us again now, I hope. I had had a talk with you this long while, and the missus here wants you to see what can be done with her best spinning wheel, for it's got broke, and it'll be a nice job to mend it, there'll want a bit o' turning. You'll come as soon as you can now, will you? Mr. Poyser paused and looked round, while he was speaking, as if to see where Hetty was, for the children were running on before. Hetty was not without a companion, and as he had, besides, more pink and white about her than ever, for she held in her hand the wonderful pink and white hothouse plant, with a very long name, a Scotch name, she supposed, since people said Mr. Craig the gardener was Scotch. Adam took the opportunity of looking round too, and I am sure you will not require of him that he should feel any vexation in observing a pouting expression on Hetty's face as she listened to the gardener's small talk. Yet in her secret heart she was glad to have him by her side, for she would perhaps learn from him how it was Arthur had not come to church. Not that she cared to ask him the question, but she hoped the information would be given spontaneously, for Mr. Craig, like a superior man, was very fond of giving information. Mr. Craig was never aware that his conversation and advances were received coldly, for to shift one's point of view beyond certain limits is impossible to the most liberal and expansive mind. We are none of us aware of the impression we produce on Brazilian monkeys of feeble understanding. It is possible they see hardly anything in us. Moreover, Mr. Craig was a man of sober passions, and was already in his 10th year of hesitation as to the relative advantages of matrimony and bachelorhood. It is true that, now and then, when he had been a little heated by an extra glass of grog, he had been heard to say of Hetty that the ass was well enough, and that man might do worse, but on convivial occasions men are apt to express themselves strongly. Martin Poyser held Mr. Craig in honor as a man who knew his business, and who had great lights concerning soils and compost, but he was less of a favorite with Mrs. Poyser, who had more than once said in confidence to her husband, "You're mighty fond o' Craig, but for my part, I think he's welly like a cock as thinks the sun's rose o' purpose to hear him crow." For the rest, Mr. Craig was an estimable gardener, and was not without reasons for having a high opinion of himself. He had also high shoulders and high cheekbones, and hung his head forward a little as he walked along with his hands in his breeches pockets. I think it was his pedigree only that had the advantage of being Scotch, and not his bringing up, for except that he had a stronger burr in his accent, his speech differed little from that of the Loamshire people about him. But a gardener is Scotch, as a French teacher is Parisian. Well, Mr. Poyser, he said, before the good slow farmer had time to speak, ye'll not be carrying your hay tomorrow, I'm thinking. The glass sticks a change, apostrophe, and ye may rely you o' my word as we'll ha' more downfall afore 24 hours is past. Ye see that darkish blue cloud there you o' the horizon, ye know what I mean by the horizon, where the land and sky seems to meet. I see the cloud, said Mr. Poyser, risin' or no risin'. It's right or Mike Holdsworth's fallow, and a foul fallow it is. Well, you mark my words, as that cloud'll spread o'er the sky pretty nigh as quick as you'd spread a tarpaulin over one o' your hay ricks. It's a great thing to ha' study to look o' the clouds. Lord bless you. Th meteorological almanacs can learn me nothing, but there's a pretty sight o' things I could let them up to, if they'd just come to me. And how are you, Mrs. Poyser? Thinking o' Jeter and the red currants soon, I reckon. You'd a deal better jeether 'em afore they're aware of why such weather as we've got to look forward to. How do ye do, Mistress Speed? Mr. Craig continued, without a pause, nodding by the way to Adam and Seth. Hope ye enjoyed them spinach and gooseberries as I sent Chester with th other day. If ye want vegetables, while ye're in trouble, ye know where to come to. It's well known I'm not giving other folks things away, for when I've supplied the house, the garden's my own speculation, and it isn't every man th old squire could get as I'd be equal to the undertaking, let alone asking, whether he'd be willing. I've got to run my calculation fine, I can tell you, to make sure o' getting back the money as I pay the squire. I should like to see some o' them fellows as make the almanacs looking as far before their noses as I've got to do every year as comes. They look pretty fur, though, said Mr. Poyser, turning his head on one side and speaking in rather a subdued reverential tone. Why, what could come truer nor that picter o' the cock why the big spurs, as has got its head knocked down why th anchor, and th firin', and the ships behind. Why, that picter was made afore Christmas, and yet it's come as true as th Bible. Why, th Cox France, and th Anchors Nelson, and they told us that beforehand. P.E.A., said Mr. Craig. Man dees no want to see fur, to know as th English all beat the French. Why, I know you o' good authority as it's a big Frenchman as reaches 5 foot high, and they live you o' spoon meat mostly. I knew a man as his father had a particular knowledge o' the French. I should like to know what them grasshoppers are to do against such fine fellows as our young Captain Arthur. Why, it 'ud astonish a Frenchman, only to look at him. His arm's thicker nor a Frenchman's body, I'll be bound, for they pinch their souls in wise days, and it's easy enough, for they've got nothing I their insides. Where is the captain, as he wasn't at church today? Said Adam. I was talking to him o' Friday, and he said nothing about his going away. Oh, he's only gone to Eagledale for a bit o' fishing. I reckon he'll be back again afore many days are o'er, for he's to be at all th arranging and preparing o' things for the coming o' age o' the 30th o' July. But he's fond o' getting away for a bit, now and then. Him and th old squire fit one another like frost and flowers. Mr. Craig smiled and winked slowly as he made this last observation, but the subject was not developed farther, for now they had reached the turning in the road, where Adam and his companions must say goodbye. The gardener, too, would have had to turn off in the same direction, if he had not accepted Mr. Poyser's invitation to tea. Mrs. Poyser duly seconded the invitation, for she would have held it a deep disgrace not to make her neighbors welcome to her house. Personal likes and dislikes must not interfere with that sacred custom. Moreover, Mr. Craig had always been full of civilities to the family at the Hall Farm, and Mrs. Poyser was scrupulous in declaring that as he had nothing to say again him, on it was a pity he couldna be hatched or again, and hatched different. So Adam and Seth, with their mother between them, wound their way down to the valley, and up again to the old house, where a saddened memory had taken the place of a long, long anxiety where Adam would never have to ask again as he entered, "Where's father?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.